Today's topic is best practices for tuning Java 5.0 garbage collection on the IBM platform. Our presenter is Chris Bailey. Chris is an IBM Java client solutions consultant. Chris joined the IBM Java Technology Center as a graduate of Southampton University in 2000. He now leads the IBM Java Service Support Team, working extensively with users to solve issues raised against IBM Java and Java-based products and ensure the success of deployments. Chris runs the DevelopmentWorks Java Zone forum entitled IBM Java Runtime and SDKs and is currently focused on improving the quality of information and tooling available to IBM Java users. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Chris.
Thanks. So as Kathy said, my name's Chris Bailey. I work for the IBM Java Client Solutions team as the worldwide lead services and support of any IBM customer running on top of the IBM Java runtimes, and that includes customers running WebSphere on the IBM platform. What we're going to cover in this session is an overview of the IBM Java Garbage Collector. And if you look at the objectives on slide 2, you see that it's to cover this overview. And we'll talk about how to select the correct GC policy. So we have effectively 4 groups of settings for the garbage collector to determine how it should run. And those roughly map to what sort of application you're running. And then how to go beyond that and select the right Java heap size and some other settings that affect the expansion and shrinkage of the Java heap, and how to do those either to look for performance or additional resilience in the system. And then we'll spend some time at the end answering any questions that you may have. So slide 3, garbage collection performance. So one of the problems is that GC performance can take many forms, and it really comes down to what is the requirements of the user for that particular application. It may be that what you're looking for is very short garbage collection pause times. It could be what you're looking for is maximum throughput, so the application has a set amount of work that it needs to do, and you want that work to be done as quickly as possible. Normally what we find is that what's required is a balance between the two. So the first step of tuning the garbage collector for performance is to first ensure that you have the right GC policy for your application type and the sort of requirement that you have. Second step is then to ensure that the heap size is correct for your level of workload. And then the third thing is to look at specific performance issues. So the first thing we're going to do is to look at selecting the correct GC policy. So on slide 4 is where we'll start that. Okay, so selecting the correct GC policy. On slide 5, just a little overview of what garbage collection does. So garbage collection is responsible for the allocation and freeing of Java objects, array objects, Java classes, any real Java application data that is stored on the Java heap. Each of these allocations for an object is done as a continuous section of Java heap. So if you allocate a byte array that has 20,000 elements, then we need a continuous part of memory in the Java heap to be able to allocate that entire array. Once the allocation is done, garbage collection is responsible for making sure that object stays alive and is present on the Java heap as long as it's being used by the Java application. And that determination is based on there being a reference to that Java object from somewhere outside of the Java heap, be it from a thread that's running some code and has execution, or from JNI global or local references and the like. Garbage collection is then responsible for reclaiming any object that's not used and to ensure that if a finalized method is in place, for that to run before the object is reclaimed. So slide 6, object allocation. It's actually worthwhile knowing a little bit about how object allocation occurs because it can affect which GC policy that you'll use. So as we said, object allocation requires a continuous part of the Java heap. An allocation of Java objects is driven by the Java application or by some Java native interface code. Now, object allocations can actually take place in one of two ways. The first is that we have parts of the Java heap which are called thread local heap. Now, it's a slightly bad term in that it's not actually reserved area of the Java heap. It's sections of the Java heap reserved to a given thread, which is spread throughout the Java heap, where only one thread can allocate into that memory. Any other thread is allowed to read it, but only one thread will allocate into that memory. And that means there's no locking consideration of other threads trying to allocate there at the same time. And that means that these allocations that go into the thread local heap can happen at very, very fast speeds. Now, the thread local heap is used for objects under 512 bytes in size. So small objects can be allocated very rapidly. Unfortunately, larger objects, those over 512 bytes in size, are allocated under a global heap lock. So only one thread can allocate a large object at a time. They're called out-of-line allocates, if you want the jargon for it. But what it means is, if you have an application which has large number of threads allocating larger objects, those over 512 bytes in size, at the same time, then you're likely to get contention on this heap lock. And the reason we point this out is we do actually have a GC policy that helps to alleviate this condition if that's what's happening. But in general, it only affects applications running on very large hardware with multiple CPUs, with large numbers of threads all allocating large objects. The 512-byte boundary for the separation between small and large objects was developed based on a lot of profiling. The vast majority of objects are under 512 bytes in size. If we move on to slide 7, object reclamation. This occurs under two scenarios. So first is that you've had an allocation failure. You try to allocate another object on the Java heap, and it's not being possible because the Java heap is filled, and we cannot find enough continuous memory for the object we're trying to allocate. So at that point, we run garbage collection, we remove all of the garbage that's on the Java heap that we no longer require, and then we allocate the object that was requested. The other option is programmatically requested garbage collection cycle. So this is a garbage collection cycle that's been requested via call to System GC or Runtime GC through JVM PI, the profiling interface, or JVM TI, the tools interface calls, or through the distributed garbage collector, which is part of RMI, the Remote Method Invocation Framework. In general, you want to avoid programmatically requested garbage collection cycles because they cause GC to happen more frequently than is required. So calls to System GC should be avoided, but it will drive GC. And when GC does occur, there's two mechanisms which are widely used for garbage collection. The first is a mark sweep collector. Second is a copy collector. IBM uses the mark sweep collector in general, or uses a combination of both if you're running generational. Slide 8, the way we do GC. So GC itself is broken into two or three steps. The first step is the mark phase, where we identify which objects on the Java heap are being used. We then have the sweep phase, where we take all of the bits of memory that aren't being used, and we effectively create a large linked list that shows us where those memory bits are, called the free list. There's an optional third phase, which is compaction. When we do compaction, we effectively move the objects that we are using down to the base of the heap in order to coalesce the sections of free memory into as large chunks as possible. And we do this to allow us to allocate those very large objects. And it's required because all objects require continuous amounts, continuous parts of memory in order to do an allocation. Now, all of these happen in a stop the world phase of GC. So the application pauses whilst garbage collection does this work. And for this reason, we try and do every step of garbage collection, mark, sweep, and compact, as a parallel task using multiple threads to try and execute as quickly as possible. And we do different work depending on which GC policy you've chosen. As I said, we group together application types and have a GC policy that matches that type. We have four policies: op throughput, which is really for batch applications; opt average pause, which is designed for applications with responsiveness criteria; gencon for highly transactional applications; and subpools, which is for large applications which are allocating large numbers of large objects and seeing contention on that heap block because we have multiple threads trying to allocate objects over 512 bytes in size. So if we look at the first of those policies, parallel GC, which is op throughput, this uses a parallel mark sweep collector. So we have those three phases from the slide before with compaction avoidance. So we try and avoid compaction unless we have to do it. It was created to use all of the processors available on the system, and it was designed to try and increase the performance of garbage collection for SMP boxes, so multi-CPU boxes, without affecting the performance on a single CPU box. And this policy is optimized for throughput. So if you have a batch-type application where you have a set amount of work and you just want that work to finish as quickly as possible, then op throughput is the right policy to use. And it consists of a single flat Java heap with something called the LOA in there, which is the large object area. And this is a reserved area for large objects over 64K in size as a method of trying to avoid those compactions needed to coalesce free memory when you're allocating very large objects. As I said, it's parallel and it tries to use all of the available CPU on the box. Now, it does that, as we see on slide 10, using a series of GC helper threads. So the GC helper threads are effectively a parked set of threads. So they're sat there idle, doing no work until GC starts. When GC starts, these parked threads are woken up and share the work of doing garbage collection. When we decide which objects are live on the heap, these threads take part in that work. They take part in building the free list of where we have available memory in order to do the new allocates. And in fact, they do take part in compaction as well as of Java 5. So all of the work of GC is done in parallel using a number of these GC helper threads, as well as the thread that started GC, be it the thread that called system GC or the thread that had the allocation failure. The number of GC helper threads we've got is dependent on the number of processing units. Now, there's a reason why we're using the term processing units. It's not the number of CPUs. If you have a 4-CPU box and you're running SMT or hyper-threading, which gives you effectively 2 threads running per CPU, we actually have twice as many processing units there. So 4 CPUs plus SMT would actually give you 8 processing units. And this means that we have 7 GC helper threads plus the thread that started GC. So during GC, we will have 8 threads running trying to use all 8 available processing units to get garbage collection completed as soon as possible. Whilst that's appropriate when you have only one Java application running on your machine and that's the only application you care about, if you have 20 of them running on the same 4 CPUs, having that many GC helper threads may not be a good thing. So it's configurable using the command line option -X GC threads. So if you wanted to set the number of GC threads to 3, you can set -X GC threads 3, and that means there would be 4 threads doing garbage collection, the one that started the GC plus the 3 helper threads. So when you have a large number of Java applications on the same box, you should probably be reducing the number of GC helper threads. Now, the next slide, slide 11, gives a diagrammatic view of how this works. So at the top, you see standard garbage collection. This would be on a single processor box where you have 4 threads running the application, and then one of those threads starts GC through an allocation failure, and then there's a mark phase, a sweep phase, and a compaction phase before the application starts again. As you can see in the next line, we try and avoid compaction because compaction is very often the longest period of time inside the stop the world phase. In fact, if that first line was to be accurate in terms of timelines, it would be well off the slide. So we've actually made it look much smaller just to fit it in. In 142, we introduced parallel mark. And that gives the diagram on the third line where we had multiple threads doing the mark phase. 142 and 50 and 60, we have parallel sweep as well. So on slide 12 is the next GC policy, which is using concurrent mark and concurrent sweep, the opt average pause policy. But the difference between what you've just seen and what occurs in opt average pause is that we try and do some of the stop the world phase, not just in parallel on multiple threads, but also whilst the application is still running. At 142, we did some of the concurrent marking in parallel, concurrently with the application. In 5.0, we also do the parallel sweep concurrently whilst the application is running. As everything, this isn't free. There is a slight overhead to the throughput of the application, but you get much reduced stop-the-world times. And this kind of policy is something that you would want to use for something with user responsiveness. So a portal application, most web applications come under this category. So again, the picture view of parallel concurrent mark and sweep on slide 13. So really what you get is previously you had the top line of a stop-the-world phase for mark and sweep in purple. On the second line is what exists at 142, where in blue you'll see that we're trying to do some of the mark concurrently with the application. So that blue phase, both application code and concurrent marking is occurring whilst the thread is executing. At 5.0, you get the third line, where we have the blue phase of doing marking and execution of the application as we approach GC. And then we have the purple phase afterwards where we're doing sweeping whilst we're doing some of the application work. Now, you'll notice we have this phase of concurrent kickoff. So we start doing this marking as we approach the point that we think we're going to need to do GC. So we don't mark consistently all the way through the time the application is running. We only start to do this as we approach the time of GC. And the reason for this we can see on slide 14. One of the other side effects of running concurrent mark is that you get higher heap usage. And now this isn't significantly higher, but it is slightly higher. And the reason for this is that as the application is running and we're trying to work out which objects are in use, we will find an object that's in use and we will then look to see what objects is used by that object because we'll have to keep those as live as well. So we follow a reference to another object and we mark that object as alive. So we now have two objects which we're keeping alive because we believe they're in use. But as the application is still running, the reference can move over to the other object. So we're going to have to keep that object alive as well at the next GC cycle. So we effectively keep three objects alive even though only two are really in use. Now, the object that we kept alive that we shouldn't really will be removed at the next GC cycle, but that means our heap usage is slightly higher as a result of references moving whilst the application is being executed and us trying to mark at the same time. So slide 16, generation and concurrent GC, GenCon. So GenCon was a new GC policy introduced at Java 5 and is generational GC in a very similar concept to that used by Sun and HP in their JVMs. The concept is that most objects are only generated in order to find the results, carry out a simple transaction or so on. So most objects really don't survive long. And therefore, rather than treating all objects equal, we will treat objects which have just been created separately. And we'll deal with those by trying to garbage collect them rapidly. And if they survive a number of garbage collections, we decide they're going to stay alive for a long time. So we can think of this as having a pre-garbage collector before the other garbage collector that's only used for young objects. And in order to do this, we split the Java heap into a nursery space for young objects and the tenured or old space, which uses garbage collection in exactly the same way as the previous policy, opt-average pause. So on slide 17, this new nursery space uses the copy collector. So what happens is we have a nursery space that's split into two, an allocate space and a survivor space. As objects are allocated, they go into the allocate space. And when that allocate space becomes filled, we then start copying into the survivor space those objects in the allocate space which is still in use. Once we've moved over all of the objects which are in use into the survivor space, we then flip the spaces over. So the survivor space becomes the allocate space, and the old allocate space now becomes the survivor space. And therefore, new objects go into the new allocate space, and then we'll flip backwards again. Now, As we don't expect all objects that were allocated in the allocate space to need to be copied over to the survivor space, the break between survivor and allocate is not 50-50. The allocate space is actually much larger than the survivor space because we only expect a small percentage of those allocated to survive. And this is called the tilt ratio. One of the other advantages of using this is that we have implicit compaction by the copying as we move over. So this means that when we're running with generational concurrent, the GenCon policy, we don't expect to have to compact as often. The final and fourth policy is subpooling. So the aim of subpooling is to break the Java heap into multiple free lists. So not multiple logical sections, but multiple lists of where to find free memory on the Java heap. And the aim of this is to reduce that contention for objects being allocated over 512 bytes in size. By having multiple free lists, we can have multiple locks. And therefore, if we have a very large multiprocessor system where large amounts of large data is being allocated, we're no longer contending on one lock, we're contending on many. And that allows that heap lock contention to be relieved. So you should only be using it where there is heap lock contention. So on slide 19, we show you how to find out if you do actually have heap lock contention. You should only be selecting the subpools policy if this is the case. So we provide a tool on AlphaWorks called JLA, the Java Lock Analyzer, that, amongst other things, will let you know whether you have contention on this heap lock. Java Lock Analyzer effectively profiles every lock that's running in the Java application, be it a lock that's provided by the JVM and the Java runtime itself, or locks provided by middleware such as WebSphere, or locks provided by the application itself. If you look at slide 20, you'll see a sample report from the Java Lock Analyzer, and this is from a very simple application. You'll see the top table shows you the locks provided by the JVM runtime itself. And in the case of the Java heap lock, that's the second lock listed. And it also shows you at the bottom that locks from the Java application itself are also shown. So Java Lock Analyzer can actually be used to profile the performance and the locking of your Java application as well as the Java runtime itself. On slide 21 is a breakdown of what those columns in the report actually mean so that you can understand what the report's telling you. So if you do suspect that you have heap lock contention and you are using a large multi-CPU machine, you can install JLA and find out whether you do have heap lock contention, in which case subpools might be the right policy. So slide 22, choosing the right GC policy. So you've got the four GC policies, each optimized for a different scenario. Opt throughput for batch applications, opt average pause for applications with responsiveness criteria, GenCon for those with responsiveness criteria that are highly transactional, and subpools only for those with heap lock contention. So for most WebSphere users and for most WebSphere-based applications, really what it comes down to is, should I be using opt average pause or should I be using GenCon? Now, it is possible to make that distinction, and to do that, you really need to monitor the GC activity and look for certain characteristics. So slide 23, how to monitor GC activity. Simplest way is to use verbose GC logging. This is the minus verbose GC command line option. You can have it logged to file. If you choose not to log it to file, it will end up in the native standard error.log that WebSphere provides. But you can set it to file using minus x verbose GC log, which is, again, a Java command line option. You can specify the file name, and there's two additional parameters afterwards, x and y. X is the number of files that you want to log to, so you can have circular file writes, and Y is the number of GC cycles to put in each file. Now, it's often asked, what is the performance cost of running verbose GC? So some very, very simple testing shows that the cost is around 2% to the GC duration itself. So for a GC duration of 200 milliseconds, we found that it was adding about 4 milliseconds to do verbose GC. And that means if you've got an application where the GC overhead itself is around 5%, which is fairly high, then the overall GC overhead would become 5.1%. So what we're looking at is a 0.1% performance cost of running with Verbose GC, and that's probably the maximum I would expect to see. So my advice in general is run with Verbose GC all the time. It allows you to monitor what's going on in terms of memory usage, in terms of GC performance, and those are vital bits of information to have if you have any problems in those areas. Now, once you have the Verbose GC output, we recommend you go and graph the output using one of the available tools, such as GCMV, which is available in ISA, and then to look for some important characteristics. On slide 24, it lists what some of those is. The first one is your rate of garbage collection. So high rates of object burn, so high rates of objects being thrown away because they're no longer required, point to you having large numbers of transactional objects. And therefore, the application will probably benefit from running with GenCon. If you've got large object allocations, large objects tend to adversely affect the way that GenCon runs. Effectively, you're putting objects into the nursery and you're copying them several times. And copying an object is an expensive operation in the first place. And if your object allocations are large enough to largely fill up the nursery, then it means that we're copying them several times and the nursery is filling up very, very quickly. So in that case, it may well be that you're looking to run opt-average pause. The other characteristic to look for is large variations in heap usage. Opt-average pause tends to be best suited to applications that have fairly consistent memory usage, so there aren't rapid changes in memory usage between individual GC cycles. If you're seeing that occurring, then GenCon may be better suited because it prevents the old generation from being collected as often and tends to smooth out those variations in memory usage. As a rule of thumb, if your GC overhead's greater than 10%, you've almost certainly got the wrong GC policy in place. On slide 25, we show the output from the statistics report that's available from Garbage Collection and Memory Visualizer GCMV in ISA for the same application run under opt-average pause and under GenCon. On the left-hand side, you'll see in the very last row of the first table that the rate of garbage collection was 760 meg per minute. Running that same application under GenCon, you can see that it's risen to 970 meg per minute. And what this means is that GenCon can actually deal with throwing away that data much more rapidly. If you also look at the pause times table, you'll see that the average pause time and the maximum pause time is greatly reduced under GenCon. So for an application where you're generating data quite rapidly, moving to GenCon will allow that to be handled much better, dropping both the pause times and increasing the rate of throughput by increasing the rate of garbage collection. On slide 26, we show the graphs from GCMV for that same application looking at pause times. Now, initially, those graphs on the left for opt-average pause and on the right for GenCon look to be pretty much identical. But if you look at the y-axis, which shows the time, you'll see that the right-hand one for generational has got half the scale. So its longest GC cycle was about 2.8 seconds, whereas for opt-average pause, the longest cycle was around 6 seconds. So GenCon provided less frequent GC collection cycles and a shorter, longest collection cycle. So overall, for this application that burns through quite a large number of objects, GenCon is by far the better choice. Now on slide 27, as we said, large object allocations can cause a problem for GenCon. But how does it do that, and what do we call a large object? Well, so the definition of a large or very large object really is dependent on the size of the nursery that you can be using. So if the object's larger than the nursery itself, then the object immediately goes into the old generation, and that just removes the benefit of having the generational policy in the first place. Having that nursery there then just becomes pointless. So objects large enough not to fit in the nursery in the first place are an issue. The second case is where the object does fit into the nursery, but it mostly fills it. And that causes frequent nursery collects to have to occur, and many copies of this large object need to occur. And as copying is an expensive process, it means the performance then gets degraded there. So if very large objects are being used, you need to have a very large nursery in order to handle them. And if you when you increase the size of the nursery, the times of copy collect start to increase. And if they become too large, then really you should be using opt-average pause instead. So that's a brief overview of the different GC policies. There's four available. Really, opt-throughput should be used for batch. If you're not doing batch, then the distinction is between using opt-average pause and GenCon. Subpools, again, should only be used if you do have a problem of heap lock contention and JLA tells you you have that problem. So between these two policies of opt-average pause and GenCon, both which should apply to WebSphere-type applications, you need to look at the verbose GC and determine whether you have large amounts of data being burnt, in which case GenCon is probably the right policy. However, if you are allocating some very large objects and the nursery is being filled up rapidly, then going back to opt-average pause will probably be the right thing to do. So we're now moving on to the next part of the presentation, which is how to correctly size the Java heap. So we're first going to cover the maximum possible Java heap size, then how to select the correct Java heap size, and talk a little bit about fixed heap sizes or variable heap sizes, and then finally how to do the heap sizing for generational. So slide 30, the maximum possible heap size. Now, if you've attended any of the previous sessions on 32 versus 64-bit Java or on Java memory management, then you'll be aware of something that's on the next couple of slides to do with the 32-bit process address space and the maximum amount of memory that the OS gives you that determines what your maximum heap size can be. So 32-bit processes have a maximum heap size that's really enforced on it by the operating system and the platform. So 32 bits gives you a maximum of 4 gigabytes worth of addressability. And some of that is then used by the operating system, and some of it's allowed to the process, and which can be used for Java heap. At 64-bit, that limit disappears. So 64-bit processes really don't have this limitation, but 32-bit processes do. On slide 31, you'll see that 4 gigabyte worth of address space that's allowed to a 32-bit process. Now, of that range of memory from 0 up to 0x8f, which is 4 gigabytes, some of it's going to be used by the operating system. And how much is used and where it's used is really dependent on the operating system. So on slide 32, we give you the basic picture for Windows and AIX. On Windows, the top 2 gigabytes of addressability is used by the operating system. And an area of memory below that 2-gigabyte mark is used for the libraries, so like nt.dll and so on. So that gives the Java process something like 1.8, 1.85 gigabytes worth of memory that it can use. On AIX, the kernel takes the bottom 756 meg and the top 756 meg for the libraries. So of that memory, not all the memory that the OS gives to the Java process is available to the Java application itself, because in the same way the kernel's going to take some memory, the Java runtime needs some memory. And it uses that for what's called the native heap, and that's for some Java virtual machine resources and some backing resources for Java objects. So that memory space that's available to the Java process is effectively split, and it's split according to what the size of the Java heap is set to. So what isn't Java heap becomes the native heap. Effectively, the Java process maintains two memory pools. The native heap, so that which isn't the Java heap, is allocated using malloc and is subject to the management of the OS, and it's used for the execution engine, class loading, and allocations to underpin Java objects. So threads, classes, anything that has a GUI requires some native allocations which are off the Java heap. And this is also used for JNI code. So slide 35 shows this, that memory is split between the Java heap and the native heap. Slide 36 shows an alternative diagram for AIX, which we use when large Java heaps are requested. So if a Java heap over 1 gig is requested, we allocate the Java heap top-down, and therefore the top part of the memory available to the Java process is used for the Java heap, and the bottom part is used for the native heap. Slide 37 shows the memory layout for Linux. So in the case of Linux, only the top 1 gigabyte is used by the operating system, and therefore the Java process gets the bottom 3 gigabytes for use by the Java process itself, both the Java heap and the native heap. And finally, we show the picture for Xeos, which as a 31-bit architecture rather than 32 bits, only gets 2 gigabytes to begin with. Slide 38 shows the theoretical and advised maximum heap sizes for each of those platforms. So on AIX, the maximum possible Java heap size is actually 3.25 gig, but we don't advise that you go over 2.5 gig because you want to leave some memory for the native heap. On Linux, the maximum possible is around 3 gig, and that can be increased by using something called the huge mem kernel option. On Windows, it's 1.8 gig, and on Xeos, it's about 1.7. On slide 39, if you move to 64-bit, then the Java heap size restrictions are removed. So you don't have a limit of 3.25 gig on AIX anymore. You have a limit which is really down to the amount of free memory you've got available in terms of physical memory. However, this massive increase in the amount of Java heap size you can have doesn't come for free. 64-bit applications are slower, and that's because we have to manipulate more data and the cache performance is reduced. And 64-bit applications actually require more memory themselves because Java object references are larger, every pointer is larger, and this actually leads to the Java heap being something like 70% bigger when running 64-bit than it is under 32-bit. However, there is work being done at Java 6, WebSphere 7, on something called compressed pointers to reduce this overhead. So, slide 40, the correct Java heap size. So, left to its own devices, GC will adapt the heap size between the minimum and maximum heap size setting provided to keep the occupancy between 40 and 70%. The theory being that if the occupancy goes over 70%, GC occurs too frequently, which generally means reduction in performance. When heap occupancy drops below 40%, GC occurs very, very infrequently, but the cycles are longer than they need to be. So that means you're suffering from longer pauses than is strictly necessary for the application, and that generally means a reduction in performance as well. So you really want to size the Java heap so that the occupancy is somewhere between 40 and 70% of the maximum heap size. Now, you can therefore judge the maximum heap size by looking at the occupancy of the Java application. And again, you can find that out using verbose GC and graphing it using GCMV. And adding an extra 43% overhead to that. So if your occupancy was 70 meg, you want 100% max heap size to keep that occupancy under 70%, which is 70 meg plus 43% of 70 meg, as 43% of 70 meg is 30 meg. So a picture form of that is on slide 41, Effectively, you want to keep your heap occupancy between 40 and 70%, because if you go over 70, GC occurs to you frequently. You go under 40, you have longer garbage collection cycles than required. So keeping that occupancy in the sweet spot of between 40 and 70% is ideal. So slide 42. Fixed or variable heap sizes. So there's a lot of conflicting information about whether a heap size should be fixed by setting minimum heap size and maximum heap size to the same value so it never changes, or whether variable heap sizes should be implemented. So allowing the heap size to expand and shrink so that GC makes sure that the occupancy stays between 40 and 70%. Now, each has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of fixing the heap size is that you don't get expansion and shrinkage of the Java heap. The advantage of having variable heap sizes is that it does expand and shrink. And whether you want expansion or shrinkage to happen depends on knowing what the side effects of expansion and shrinkage is. So slide 43, expansion and shrinkage. So the act of expanding the Java heap or shrinking the Java heap, so changing its size, is actually relatively cheap. It doesn't cost a lot in performance to simply change the size of the Java heap. However, when we do this, it can cause a compaction cycle to occur as part of GC, and compaction is very expensive. So when we expand the Java heap, we make it bigger, GC may already have had to do a compaction in order to allocate the object before we do the expansion. So it's possible compactions can happen when we expand. In the same way for shrinkage, in order to shrink the Java heap, so moving it from being, say, 1 gig down to 900 meg, if there are any objects in that top section of the Java heap between 900 meg and 1 gig, we have to move those objects in order to be able to shrink the Java heap. And therefore, in order to move those objects, we have to compact. So whilst expansion and shrinkage of the Java heap will optimize the heap occupancy for performance, it can do so at the cost of compaction cycles, which is bad for performance. So slide 44, when do we expand the Java heap? So we'll expand the Java heap if there's not enough free memory in order to be, for GC to do its allocation. So we have a compaction cycle. So once GC has completed its work, if there's not enough free space for the object to do the allocation, then we will expand. And that will occur after a compaction cycle. The other case that we will expand is if the occupancy is over 70%. So we've gone over that 70% marker, and we will now expand the Java heap. We also expand if you spend more than 13% of time in GC. Of all of those three cases, only the first one is likely to have a compaction cycle. So this means we typically don't compact before expanding. If we look at the same slide 45, heap shrinkage, the same rules apply really. We'll shrink if the occupancy is under 40%. However, we won't do that if the heap's been recently expanded or if we're doing GC as a result of the forced GC cycle. But we will compact if there's an object in the area that we want to shrink or that we did not shrink on the previous cycle. So what this means is compactions are likely to occur. It's unlikely that compactions occur during expansion, but it's very likely that they will occur during shrinkage. So if you look at slide 46, there are certain things that we can do to try and mitigate these expansions and shrinkages and still not have the Java heap fixed. And these are using minf and maxf. So the 40 and 70% occupancy bounds are actually controlled using the maxf and minf setting. So the max F is the maximum free space before shrinkage, and it's set to 0.6 as the default, and that controls the 40% boundary. So when there's more than 60% free, we will shrink. The converse is minf, the minimum free space before we'll expand, and that defaults to 0.3, which is the 30% at the top. So when there's 30% less than 30% free, will expand, so occupancy is over 70%. So you can actually use these values to move where that optimum occupancy window is. If you intentionally want to allow occupancy less than 40%, then you can change the max F setting to allow that to occur. One of the side effects is that you could set up your min F and max F setting to allow the heap to expand, so to make sure that you never have occupancy over 70%, but to completely prevent shrinkage. And you can do this by setting minus X max F 1.0, which says only shrink if the heap's 100% free. So that would allow the Java heap to keep expanding if the occupancy goes up, and never to go over the 70% occupancy. But if the usage then drops, we won't shrink back down again. If you look at slide 47, there are also another two options that might be of interest, minus X maxi and minus X mini. These are the minimum maximum amounts that we will expand and shrink by. The maximum is defaulted to unlimited, and the minimum is set to 1 megabyte. So this means when we do expand, we will expand by at least 1 meg. So we can actually prevent multiple expansions happening in a row by saying, if you're going to expand, expand by at least 20 meg. So if you look at slide 48, this shows the effect of minus X min E. So when we go over that 70% occupancy as set by minus X min F, we'll then expand by at least the value set by minus X min E. And then obviously the boundaries for minus X min F and minus X max F move as appropriate. So slide 49, back to the question of whether to have fixed or variable heap sizes. It really depends on the application. If you have flat memory usage, so your memory usage is consistent over time, then maybe having fixed heap sizes and not having expansions and shrinkages, and therefore not having compactions for those reasons, is a good thing. However, if you've got widely varying memory usage, then you're often going to go into the over 70% utilized or under 40% utilized, which starts to give you a performance problem. And in fact, if you have an application that, say, is a commerce application, and you have an unexpected peak in usage on, say, Thanksgiving, and that increases the memory usage dramatically, if your maximum heap size is not big enough, you'll get an out-of-memory error. So by fixing the Java heap size, you actually remove the flexibility from the system and remove the resilience. So what you could do is have the ability for the Java heap size to grow and have a very large maximum heap size, but not expand to that level. And if there's a huge peak in load, you can then expand to that level and avoid out-of-memory errors or performance problems because the maximum heap size isn't big enough. You can then prevent the compactions that would be associated with the shrinkage by using minus X max F 1.0, and therefore we wouldn't compact to shrink. And you can therefore decide manually when to reset the Java heap by restarting the process, or only having shrinkages occur when the occupancy comes down to a very low level, again using minus X max F to a value of say 0.1. So only once the load has dropped off dramatically would you shrink. So having variable heap sizes adds resilience to the system and allows GC to manage vast changes in load and vast changes in memory usage. If the heap size is fixed, you do avoid the compaction cycles associated with expansion and shrinkage, but it also means that if there's an unexpected change in memory usage, the system's very brittle, and in fact, if that memory usage increases dramatically, then you can get out of memory errors. Slide 50, heap sizing for generational GC. As I said, with generational GC, you can think of it as having the same GC policy you have for opt-average pause, but with an additional heap space put on the front, which is the nursery. So if you look at sizing the nursery, you've got two options. You can either fix the nursery in 10-year heap spaces, or you can allow the size of the nursery and the size of the 10-year to old space to move between the two. The advice is to fix the new space size, so the 10-year space is also fixed in itself. So you size the 10-year to old generation exactly as you would for a flat heap, use exactly the same settings as you would for opt-average pause, but you also then size the nursery as its own as its own space. And if you look on slide 51, sizing the nursery, effectively, the copying from the allocator to the survivor space is expensive. We're copying physical data, and that doesn't take a trivial amount of time. So ideally, you want the survival rate to be as low as possible, so we have to collect and move as little as possible. So what this means is the bigger the nursery that you have, the lower the survival rate, and the less time we'll actually spend doing the copies. However, the bigger the nursery, the longer the copy can potentially take. So the recommendation on sizing the nursery is to effectively keep growing the size of the nursery in iterations until the GC time for nursery collects is as long as you can accept with your responsiveness criteria. And at that point, stop increasing it and have that. So very large nurseries are recommended for performance reasons, providing, of course, that you can fit them inside your allowable maximum heap space if you're using 32-bit. Effectively, if you move from opt-average pause through to Gen Con, you will need to increase your overall heap size to account for that additional nursery on the front. You want to keep the old generation exactly sized as you had previously. So one of the side effects of moving to generational is that you need more memory. So slide 52, in summary, the GC policy should be chosen according to the scenario. Really, you're probably looking at opt-average pause and generational, and which you should use really depends on object burn rate and whether you're using large objects. In terms of heap sizing, the heap should be sized for occupancy between 40 and 70%. That normally gives you your best return in terms of GC performance. And whether or not you should set min and max heap size really depends on whether avoiding compactions is critical for you, or whether you want to build resilience into the system. I'd normally recommend setting them different in order to allow for resilience and to allow for the application, allow for garbage collection to keep occupancy between 40 and 70% for you, and to account for those cases where load peaks suddenly through the roof and memory goes up as a result. By allowing GC to adjust for that, then you won't get out of memory areas, which will take the system down. So finally, on slide 53, there's some resources linked to you there for the WebSphere products. And slide 54 is links to some documentation about Java itself. The most useful ones there are probably the fourth link, the troubleshooting of Java through IBM Guided Activity Assistant, and the fifth link, which is an info center of the same content. There's some content in there on how to size the Java heap, how to tune it for performance, and then how to deal with out-of-memory errors. And the final link is the link to the DeveloperWorks forum that I run that Kathy mentioned in the introduction. So finally, any questions?
And our first question.
Hi, the question I have is the AIX or Windows system where we are using more than 4 gig of memory. It's like 8 gig or I guess 16 gig on the AIX side. How can we use the rest of the memory? Because here it's showing up, it's as if the one instance of WebSphere is able to use up like 4 gig only.
If you're running in 32-bit processes, so if you're running 32-bit WebSphere, then the maximum amount of memory that one instance can use is 4 gigabytes. If you want to use more than 4 gigabytes for a process, then you need to be using 64-bit versions of WebSphere. that's just a limitation of 32-bit architectures.
So that's valid even if we have multiple applications used in that 32-bit. Those, even if we have like five applications, all will be sharing that 1.5 or 2 gig of memory space that's allocated for JVM.
No. So if you have multiple, each process gets its own 4 gigs worth of addressability. Now, you hope that you back that with physical memory, but if you don't, you can back it with paging space, so disk. If you have 16 gigs worth of RAM and you have four processes, each using 4 gigabytes, then you will use the full 16 gig of RAM. But no single process can use more than 4 gig.
Okay, so the single process you're referring is not that one instance of WebSphere install, but it's a web one instance of an application.
Yeah, so it's one process. So if you have a cluster and you've got four nodes in that cluster, you've got four processes. So those four processes can each be 4 gig in size.
Okay.
Our next question.
I have two questions, actually. One is the relationship between object finalization and garbage collection.
Yeah.
And the second one is the K cluster parameter in evaluating and analyzing, you know, garbage collection and the impact that has on the different garbage collection models.
Okay, so for your first point about finalization, so what would you like to know?
Well, for instance, I have one analysis that indicates a large number of objects that are queued for finalization.
Yeah.
And that seems to have an impact in the garbage collection. So I would like to know a little bit more how that happens.
Okay, so the mechanism of finalization is that when we detect an object is no longer in use, it can be garbage collected. If it's got a finalizer, we cannot garbage collect it that cycle. So we put it on a list. And that's where you're seeing queued for finalization. So once GC finishes and the application starts running again, there's a thread that walks down this list of finalizers and runs the method, that's the finalized method for that object. And once that's run, the next GC cycle after it's run, the object becomes available to be collected finally. So what this means is any object with a finalizer is delayed from being collected by at least one GC cycle. If it takes the thread that runs all the finalized methods more than one GC cycle to get to your object, then it could be longer than that. So the effect on your memory usage is that your memory usage is going to be slightly higher because your objects are staying alive slightly longer because it needs the finalized method to run. So ideally, not having a finalized method is better because objects are released quicker. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, your second point on K-clusters. So K-clusters only exist in the 1.4.2 version of Java. As of Java 5 and in Java 6, they're no longer required, so they don't exist at all. Neither does the problem that you may be aware of residual fragmentation. So neither of those exist from Java 5. In terms of the way they work with 1.4.2, they don't really affect the GC policies themselves. When you specify the K-cluster to hold the classes, it just gets allocated at the base of the Java heap and won't move. So it doesn't really affect GC policies or the way you size the heap. You just need to specify it to the total number of classes you have, and it reserves a section for those classes at the base of the Java heap.
Okay.
But yeah, as I said, it's not required from Java 5 onwards because of a change in the way that the heap's managed.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Hello, Chris. First of all, thanks for the great presentation. It was very helpful and interesting. Actually, I have two questions left. First, regarding the concurrent sweep in Java 5, is this done by default or how can this be activated?
So when you move to opt-average pause, so minus XGC policy, opt-average pause, you automatically get concurrent mark and concurrent sweep. So they're both activated at the same time.
Okay, opt-average pause does both on Java 5, but not on 1.4.2.
No, so opt-average pause at 1.4.2 only gives you concurrent mark. There is no concurrent sweep at 1.4.2.
Okay, that's a bit weird. Second question is regarding the number of GC helper threads.
Yes.
What about symmetric multiprocessing or multi-threading systems, CPUs basically?
Yeah, so what we do is we create a GC helper thread. Well, we run GC with one thread per processing unit available. So if you're running on a machine with four CPUs and two cores per CPU, you've got eight. If you then have hyper-threading or SMT, symmetric multi-threading, each of those can handle two threads. So at that point, you're up to 16 processing units. So we'll create 15 GC helper threads.
And, okay, and from the experience, yeah, does it make sense to run with 15 helper threads, or is it better to reduce it to the number of cores, or to 8 in our example?
So it makes sense to run with that many GC helper threads if the only thing that you're running is Java and you're only running it once. If you've got multiple Java applications running in that same area on the box, so you've got a partition that gives you 8 CPUs, then and you've got 20 Java applications, then no, it doesn't make sense to run the default number of GC helper threads, and it does make sense to drop that number so they aren't competing against each other.
Okay, but this is independent from the hyper-threading, but that's very obvious without hyper-threading, but I'm just thinking about if really hyper-threading is sufficient for running multiple GC helper threads.
So the fact that you don't get the thread running on hyper-threading doesn't actually perform as well as the one natively running on the CPU.
Yeah.
So effectively, the JVM doesn't know whether hyper-threading or SMT is running.
Exactly, yeah.
We query the operating system, and the operating system tells us how many processing units there are. And therefore, the JVM itself doesn't know. It may make sense to drop the number of GC helper threads, yes, but that would be down to the user because the user would have to know to do it.
Yeah, okay, but that was actually the question, yeah. Does it make sense to run with hyper-threading with the full number of GC helper threads, or is it a good advice to reduce the number of GC helper threads if you're running on hyper-threaded CPUs?
I think if you're running hyper-threaded and it's only the one Java application that's running, then I think it still makes sense to apply a thread into the to use the default number of GC helper threads. And the reason for that is the cache locality. The fact that the two threads on the CPU are doing almost the same thing means they'll benefit from the same caching.
Okay.
So for that reason, it probably makes sense to stick with the default. If you've got any other processes running, then it normally makes sense to drop it, though.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the presentation. How much of what we covered today in this presentation and the last discussion on helper threads applies to i5OS WebSphere running on iSeries Power i systems?
Okay, so it depends which version you're running on i5OS. So if you're running 32-bit Java 5, then it's the same JVM, it's identical.
Okay.
When the i5OS refers to the classic JVM, then you've got a completely different layout for GC, and in fact it's a completely different JVM.
That's the 64-bit?
Yeah, so they're still using the classic for 64-bit, and that's completely different. But if you're running 32-bit, you've got the same JVM, the same GC, and all of this applies.
Okay, so running 32-bit, everything in this presentation applies. If you're running classic, then all bets are off.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, this time we will conclude the presentation.